Welcome to the Shift Extension Podcast. Welcome back, everyone, to the podcast. We're doing things a little bit differently today. We have some very special guests on, and that is Megan, Nick, and Andy from the Clinical Practice Radio. So welcome, guys, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Yeah, we're really excited. So it's nice to talk to you guys all the way over there on the other side of the world, or Australia at least, anyway. So
feels like that, doesn't it?
It does. It does. Yeah. Coming to you from Western Australia. So looking forward to the chat.
Yeah. So today we've kind of picked sort of two topics that are very relevant to paramedic practice, and they are communication and collaboration.
I mean, communication's an interesting one, isn't it? Because we do it every single day. Like, there's not many other clinical skills as a paramedic that you use on every single job that you go to, no matter what that job is, whether it's low acuity, high acuity, even just talking between colleagues, handing patients over. Like, there are so many different elements of communication that it's essential, and it's probably something that we spend the least amount of time training for and preparing for. So yeah, it's one of those forgotten skills. I think we kind of just learn it as you go. Like, what even makes you a good communicator?
I think it's one of those ones that people just assume that they're a good communicator. Hey, I'm good at talking because I talk all the time. That doesn't make you a good communicator. It just means you talk a lot, right? So there's, I think, a massive difference between talking a lot and effectively communicating, and what that may even look like. And I agree with Nick, like, it's not something that we traditionally train for. We just assume that we're going to be able to do or be good at. And some people are definitely naturally better at it. Sure, there's that. But if we want to be a really good clinician, the best clinicians are highly effective communicators. And so I think we should look at, like, what they do, what kinds of things that they do in order to be those highly effective communicators. And then maybe we can distill that out, and then we can take those lessons and use them for ourselves.
Why, Megan, let me direct this to you, because there's some interesting things to unpack even from that opening conversation. I think Nick's right. Communication is probably one of those skills that we use the most, yet the irony is it's least discussed, it's least presented, and it's probably one of the least topics that I've heard presented educationally. Why is it something that we're doing every day, yet it's also something that we neglect the most in our own development?
That's a very good question. I think it's also one of those things, communication just comes up in every single debrief that you run. It's like, in a job that's gone really well, communication is usually the overarching kind of theme of that. And for a job that maybe has gone not so well, it's usually like, oh, we could have communicated better. It kind of always tends to come up in that sort of thing. But in terms of why, I guess, we're not practicing as much or training as much, it kind of falls under one of those like soft skills we've sort of all spoken about before, those non-technical skills, which I guess currently is a little bit de-emphasized when it comes to training. There's such a big drive for the more like clinical aspects of training, especially
the sexy stuff.
Do you know what I think it is, Sunny? Yeah. Do you know what I think it is? It's really hard to measure. Yeah. It's really hard to measure. Oh, look, you're a really great communicator. You're an 8 out of 10 communicator. Yeah. All right. Well, there's like, yeah, but, so.
Yeah. But what does that look like?
What does it look like? Yeah.
And it's really,
yeah.
It is really easy to measure, though, when you're a bad communicator. Like, it's really hard to measure the good, but you always know. Every debrief you do, if there's something that went wrong, it'll be like communication, and you can pick it every single time, but you can never pick the ones that we like, yeah, communication went really well, because things just work smoothly. They just go well.
I feel like the person who's the bad communicator, though, it's not obvious to them. I feel like it's the person who's been communicated to that can pick that up. It's interesting that, I mean, you know, we've even called it a soft skill already. And I mean, I've heard a lot of debate around soft skills, hard skills, and technical skills. Mm. And I'm not going to get into, you know, the language of it. But it's actually quite a hard skill to develop and ascertain. So whether it's a soft skill or not, I don't know if that's appropriate to define it with. But there's an irony too. Megan, you talked about debriefing really quickly. And I'm curious, Because Lou and I, we're very separate from services right now. We're part of the profession, working in a very grey area, that's been sort of less supported and less recognised, since the concept of paramedicine registration. But debriefing my own experiences previously I think I've worked in half a dozen different ambulance services over my career, as well as the private sector. But debriefing something that was only done if there was a big job, and in quotation marks, a big job, because what we even define as a big job, I sometimes disagree with staunchly as well. It's normally a multi-CAS, or it's normally a case that's gone badly. But you said one of the things in debriefing that comes up if it's a good job is that communication is done well. I'm curious to know how often you guys actually debrief, because apart from communication being one of the neglected skills that paramedics have, I feel like there is not even nearly enough debriefing attempted. Paramedics just literally expected to go from job to job to job to job to job without any kind of feedback mechanism to support them. And the only time there really seems to be a discussion is if they're going to be in trouble or if there's something that's gone wrong. How often are you guys debriefing?
I could not agree more with that.
Mm.
It's so dependent on the individual, for us anyway, on how frequently you're debriefing. And it's the same sort of thing. It's done after, in quotations, a big job, whether that's a, cardiac arrest or a major trauma or something like that. And it's usually done in the setting where it's like, everyone's gathered around the ambulance after the event, whether it's on scene or at the hospital, when you kind of have a bit of a chat about what happened and what went well. But it's very, in my experience anyway, quite informal. And I guess there's not really ever too many follow-up points after a debrief. Like, if something does go really well, let's say it's communication, you're like, wow, that was great. I don't know, closed loop communication, or your direction and leadership was done really well. And then maybe another aspect that wasn't done so well, it's not really followed up. Like, there's no action points to follow up to that.
There's a lot in this. Again, I think it comes back to this whole quantifiable thing, right? So again, like I mentioned with the communication, it's hard to measure. It's also hard to measure for people, for organizations like ambulance services who are running on things like KPIs, right? KPIs, like, how fast did you drive to the job is a KPI. Well, okay, we'll leave that one where it should be. But how does the service quantify and then therefore place importance on things like debriefing when it's a very qualitative thing? And for some people, they need more, some people need less, some jobs need more, some jobs need less. But you can't put it in a profit and loss sheet. You can't put it on a Excel. Do you know what I mean? Oh, look, X number of debriefs gave us X number of jobs that gave us X number of money or whatever. Like this, it just doesn't work like that.
I was going to say with that as well, there's not really any element of information sharing to look if there are common themes across all these different jobs that people are going to of all different groups. It's like it's there, and I know that that's
It's
obviously
siloed.
sometimes sensitive information, but yeah, very siloed.
So we are looking at some improvements in that space, and part of that is around giving it a little bit more structure. But then there's also the inherent danger of overly structuring debriefs, which means that they can lose their effectiveness. So this is an area I think, the world of paramedicine, the professionalization of paramedicine, and both in jurisdictional ambulance and outside of jurisdictional ambulance, is definitely, and it's evolving, right? It's in a state of flux.
It's in
And I think
it's
in
in its
the
infancy.
it is in its
We
infancy,
are
yeah. And
babies. With
the in those early years of our, we've only been registered here since 2018. Prior to that, we really measured our professionalism by our scope of practice. Hey, cool, look at all the things we can do. Look at all the drugs we carry. Look at all the interventions we can do. That must make us professional. Well, that's not true. That's not how it works. That's just a list of skills, right? That doesn't make you a professional. Unfortunately, that was kind of how where we hung our hat in terms of like, this is what makes us good at our job. The thing that truly makes us professional is those other skill sets, like what we're starting to talk about now, those that highly developed communication, the ability to collaborate both intra-professionally and then also interoperability within services and the like. And then things like debriefing flow off the back of that, mentoring flows off the back of that, all of these things that will actually define us as a profession moving forward. are still very much in the development phase. This is an area that we need to really dig into now as a profession moving forward.
And I just and just to point out that actually a part of our professional capabilities for paramedics in one of the like main domains is being able to communicate and collaborate. You know, that is a main domain, and I think that it sometimes is very much overlooked in my experience in the university setting as well. I don't know if that's other people's experience, but I think why is it you know, something that we must be able to do as clinicians, yet there isn't really a course at uni that teaches you how to be a great communicator. It's just something that I found really interesting. And when I was thinking about this podcast, as someone who's just come out of the university setting, I felt that that is something that could have been done a little bit better.
I think we assume, like, it's one of those skills that we assume we all know how to do. And every single paramedic is a really, really good communicator just because they're a paramedic and we associate that with the identity. So, like, what does make a good communicator? Like, what are some of those real good things that we've seen that show people can communicate well?
Is that collaboration, which obviously we're talking about today, but not just being, again, siloed into that paramedic practice, but people that have got lots of experience in other areas. It's like those experiences are going to build your communication skills, dealing with different groups of people, and not just being in that sort of pre-hospital bubble.
What if I challenge all of us as professional registered paramedics with experience? What if I challenge all of us and say there's an irony here? Because we're all approaching this with our own inherent bias. We assume paramedics are good communicators. Therefore, as paramedics, we assume we are good communicators. Therefore, when we move into clinical educator roles, senior positions, and academic roles, we assume that we are good communicators. And then we are the people that the next generation are learning from. So you can draw this right back to, well, what's a student experience? When's the last time any of us actually approached a student to seek feedback from them? We're very good at giving them feedback. We're very good at criticizing their ability to communicate or practice. But when's the last time we actually sought feedback from them? Because we are demonstrating to them how to act. And I'm going to put this in quotation marks professionally. But, you know, I've worked in several universities as well as ambulance service, and so often I've been disappointed in the way our profession treat the next generation. And so I find an irony when people talk about, you know, communication and collaboration, because I see a massive disconnect, and also a lack of professional approach to this topic. Because I just haven't seen it in practice. And so, Lou, I'd love to actually hear from your experiences as someone who's gone through that, you know, let's call it the lowest level. I'm not trying to be condescending here, but let's face it, that's the way it's kind of hierarchically structured. What's been your
Let's
experience?
call it entry level, Sonny. That's slightly
Okay,
less, you know,
there we
like
go.
that's,
Thank you, Andrew. I appreciate that.
yeah,
Lou,
that's all right. That's all right, Stephen. All right, no problem.
Professor Stephen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What's been your experience, Lou, in terms of how you were communicated to, from how you were, I'm going to put this in quotation marks, mentored, Andy, you'll love that, tormentored. What's been your experience?
So overall, I had a really great experience on with my placements. In saying that, I'm a mature age student. I have a background in vet nursing. I have experience in, I guess, communicating already and working a part of a team as a part of a team. So for me, I felt that I fit in quite well. But when I would say that the communication was sort of let down by my mentors, wasn't even when they were talking to me. It was when I was sitting in the back of the ambulance and I could hear what they were saying, obviously in the front. And it was sort of negative comments around the, I want to be really careful what I say here, but just the workplace culture and how things were run for that particular service. And that sort of filters down, and you hear that as a student, and you go, oh, okay, so this is how I talk, and this is how I conduct myself when I have students. It's fine for me to talk about this stuff. And I found that really disappointing because I'm really excited about the profession and really excited about where we can take it. And so when I was having my mentors talk to me, they were generally very good. I felt that I got along with them really well. That's just my experience. But it was more when we finished a job, or it was nearing the end of the shift and they'd just been given another job, and hearing the communication about how they felt about their service to me was, I suppose, like a bit of a letdown, because I thought they'd be a lot more excited about, what they can do for their community. And I've also had friends that have had awful experiences with mentors who their communication was very abrupt and unnecessarily rude as well. And especially when you're in that teaching space, and again, bringing it back to the professional capabilities, is we have to be able to mentor students, right? And so I've had friends that have had awful experiences where it's like eat your own young kind of thing, and we're not uplifting the students. And so I think for a lot of people, they have had really poor communication from mentors that probably have gone away and haven't reflected on it. Yeah, so I think it's a bit of a mixed bag depending on who you are and who you get as a clinician. But for me, overall, it was pretty good. But what let me down was hearing people communicate about the profession in a negative light. So yeah, that's, I don't know if that answered your
Yeah,
question, but that's my
there's more to
experience.
what you're saying though, because you actually preempted that whole kind of experience with when I was sitting in the back of the ambulance. And I find this really interesting because so often when you have students graduating, you can ask them, are you ready? And a lot of them are not ready. A lot of them are waiting for that grad year, depending on what service they're going to be a part of. But I find it interesting because all through their educational experience, we're treating them as a student, and then suddenly they're supposed to act as a paramedic. We've never given them a chance to act as a paramedic. Imagine if we treated a third-year student like a human and like a paramedic. Imagine if instead of sitting that person in the back of the ambulance, we put them in the front seat, said, I'll sit in the back. Imagine how that would communicate to the students and set them up for a much better experience. But there's so much more here. Now, there's a lot of excuses, our shift work breaks you down. The trauma that we see breaks you down. And look, I do understand that. I mean, far out, I spent 7 years in the army and 14 years as a paramedic. I understand how these things can break you down, but you've also can't excuse that when you come back to the professional capabilities document specifies what a paramedic is expected to do. And a lot of professional paramedics haven't even read that document, which the irony is then the next generation of student who are coming through who write assignments on that document are actually more familiar with the professional capabilities expected of a paramedic than a paramedic who's been in the job 20 years. And again, I draw back to how often have we sought feedback from someone below us? It's quite a humbling thing to do. But I, Andy, you wrote a paper. Ah, what am I talking about? We wrote a paper. And I loved the title. So here's the self-promotion. What's the title?
Mentor or tormentor?
Mentoring and tormentoring, because Lou kept talking about mentors there, but they didn't sound like mentors.
I think I know Nick has something to comment on, so I'll put a little pin in that. Nick, jump in, and then I've got some thoughts I'd like to run through.
I was going to say, what I find really interesting about your experience, Lou, and something that we can all take away as mentors of paramedics and students coming through the system, is that the stuff that you were hearing while you were kind of in that decompressive phase where, the job's finished, your cognitive load is decreased, you're going to be absorbing that information more than potentially some of the things you heard on the job when, you're focused on watching the skills and communicating with the patient as well. So we really need to be mindful of those conversations that we're having when, when everything is kind of decompressed, because you're going to take in way more of those subtle nonverbal cues that they were having in the front.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yep.
There's a lot there. I think we probably need to do a second or third episode of this and just dig into mentoring, because that's a rabbit hole that I'd love to go down a long, long way. But if we just kind of bring it back in terms of where we are today in around communication and collaboration, one of the biggest issues that we see in mentoring, if we talk about collaboration, collaboration is teamwork, right? It's working together to achieve a better outcome. That means both sides of the coin, and there's often a hierarchical power disparity within the mentor slash mentor mentee relationship. One of the biggest issues that we have in our environment is that the mentor is afforded a position of power hierarchically above the student, making it no longer a shared collaborative relationship because the student is beholden to the mentor. I need this mentor to sign me off on my thing, otherwise I'm going to fail. Otherwise I don't get the thing, right? And as soon as you have that, then you lose the ability to actually collaborate really effectively because one of you is always going to do the thing that they think is going to be best to get them over the line or anything else. So there's a massive issue there. On top of that, there's a language piece. And Lou, you commented on some of the things that people would say just almost offhandedly about how they were feeling about their job or their service or, you know, shift work sucks and the blah, blah, blah. Words matter. What we say matters. People remember things. Sonny, I know you would know this from your years of lecturing like myself. You'll say something in an offhandish way in a lecture from 7 years ago that you have no idea you said and you don't remember saying it. And then you'll run into a former student of yours on a ramp somewhere or somewhere else in a bar maybe. And they'll be like, "Hey, you remember that time that you said blah, blah, blah?" And you're like, absolutely not. I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. But that does sound like something I would probably say. So the thing is that what we say matters, and the things that we say, particularly when we have people, and we've all been the mentee, we've all been the student coming through, and we've looked at those people that are on the next rung in the ladder, and you've put them up on a pedestal, and you're like, they're amazing. They must be so good at their job. And then you get there, and you're like, oh, this isn't that special. But then you're looking to the next rung on the ladder, and you're like, I want to be that person. And then you get there, and you're like, oh, well, that didn't change. You know. So the thing is that what we say matters. The little things matter. The little offhandish comments that we say are the things that will cumulatively build in a student, for example, like Lou, when you were talking about the little things that have been said on the ramp or whatever else, and they do mean things. They mean a lot, and it's the same with our patients. You know, we've talked a lot about communication and collaboration today here between interprofessionally between each other, but also what we say in front of the patient, what we say in front of the patient's family, what we say in front of like the general member of the public or the police officer we're working with, all of it matters because we are in a position of responsibility. Whether or not you're wearing a jurisdictional ambulance uniform or whether or not you're working on an industrial mine site or whether or not you're working on a ship somewhere, people listen to what we say. And they will remember it. So we need to pay very close attention to what we are saying. It's not just as simple as like letting it all out. Yeah, there's a lot. Let's do another episode on mentoring. I'm putting a pin in that one.
It's interesting because, you know, part of the reason that we even decided to collaborate on this podcast is CPR is from a very jurisdictional place. It's one of the state services. The shift extension is from a very grey area of paramedicine that no one actually knows much about. And we really spotlight the paramedics who are working in places and jobs and
Sonny,
experiences.
can I just before you move on? Nobody knows what paramedicine is. Nobody. Every time we ask for a
Now,
definition, I don't get me started, but
no,
every
Andy, you've been blocked on LinkedIn by several people because of
I
your
know I
opinions on
have,
it.
because I didn't
Very
question the definition
high.
of paramedicine.
I was about to say very high and powerful people, and I'm saying that to the deputy director of one of the state services. That's not lost on me. But I mean, look, also, you know, the irony is you have been blocked and silenced by people in the past who are trying to pigeonhole paramedics into one place. And you and I both know from our experiences that a paramedic is actually needed in just about every industry on the planet. It's how far we want to take it is actually the limit. And sometimes we are actually the limit for our own profession, unfortunately. I mean, I remember back during COVID, we actually wrote an article that was in it was directly related to the job shortages in healthcare. And they were going to fast track 200 No, 2,000 student nurses across Australia into healthcare roles to fill the gap. And we wrote an article that was called Trained, Ready and Underutilised, because while they were fast tracking 2,000 student nurses, second year student nurses, we had 5,000 graduated paramedics who had actually finished their degree and weren't being utilised. And the biggest criticism of that article was unexpected, because the biggest criticism directed at us to say that graduate paramedics are not ready for these other roles was actually paramedics. It was 10-year veterans, it was academics, it was assistant commissioners, it was people from the College of Paramedicine all saying that's dangerous to put a graduate paramedic in that role. And the irony is, there's no definition of what a graduate paramedic is either. When you finish your degree, you are a registered paramedic. Whether you want to talk about experience is a whole nother story. But a person who has finished a paramedic degree and registered are a registered paramedic. If we get that much criticism from our own profession about what a registered paramedic with limited experience can do, we're not going to be able to sell what a professional paramedic can do outside of ambulance services to the rest of the world unless we can believe it first. So it's been an interesting experience to see how hard it is for paramedics to even unstitch themselves from the historical relevance of ambulance into something else. But that also challenges the definitions that have been created, because some of those definitions, I mean, I read one definition that was published years ago and it's about half a page. If you can't say it in one sentence, we don't know what it is. Let me put Deputy Director Andrew Bell on the spot. What is a paramedic?
That's such a good question. I actually asked this
He's
question of a
stalling.
group. I know I asked this question of a group yesterday, and again, I got about 50 different answers. In my mind, it's a medical professional who works in unscheduled environments.
One more time.
A medical professional that works in unscheduled environments, the end, full stop.
Lou?
I think he's practiced
I'll
that.
it. Yeah, I'll accept
Oh, thank you, Lou. I appreciate you.
it.
I couldn't defer to Megan then. It's her boss.
I have to say it's great.
We don't work like that. We're talking about hierarchies and things. We're trying very hard to flatten hierarchies, to create environments where people are valued for their knowledge, skills, and attributes rather than the badge they wear or the title that they hold. And this again, I mean, if we come full circle back to where we started with communication and collaboration, that's where it starts, right? If we have people who are able to effectively communicate their role, their knowledge, their skills, and their attributes, whether or not you want to call them soft skills, non-technical skills, or anything else, it doesn't really matter. It's just a diff then those people are valuable, and those are the skills and sets that we want to be able to lean into and then be able to utilize. Again, in the mentoring space, in the leadership space, and the like, whether or not it's in a jurisdictional ambulance service, or whether or not it's on a mine site, or whether or not it's on a boat in the middle of the ocean chasing sharks, it doesn't matter. The knowledge, skills, and attributes remain the same. And that's what we want to lean into. And so I think back to the initial challenge around what is communication and collaboration in the space, I think we need to understand that 95, I had a very I've been around this industry a long time, unfortunately. It's been a
A very
while.
long time,
There was,
Andy.
yeah, shush you. And pretty much on my first day on the job, I had a very old school ambulance officer. He wasn't a paramedic because that's what they weren't. He was an ambulance officer. And he said to me, Andy, this job's pretty simple. It's 95% communication and the rest of it we just make up. And I was like, and I at the time I was like, nah, because like, what about all the cool things that go beep and bleep and I can stick needles and he was right. He was 100% right. If you can nail the communication piece, all of the other bits will fall into place. And you can, we can literally just train somebody to do the beeps and bleeps and stick the needles in people. But the communication piece is what will make them a highly effective clinician, regardless of whatever service or jurisdiction or wherever else they're working.
Well, and I think when you say, we can train people in those skills, we can, because there is one way to put a needle in someone. There is one way to take a blood pressure. There's not one way to communicate. There's about 100 different ways of communicating, and you need to use all 100 of them in different situations. You're going to be talking to different people. You're going to be talking on different scenes. There's a time to have short, sharp, direct communication. There's a time to have collaborative communication. It just varies depending on what situation you're faced, and we kind of have to be experts in all of them.
Yeah, great
Are
point.
there any experts in the world, though?
Nah. Well, there's a lot of people that think they're experts.
There's a lot of experienced people, Sonny, but experience does not equate to expertise.
No, and I think, I hear SME get thrown around a lot too. And I mean, even sometimes I've been grabbed in as an SME, and I always say to people, you know what? There would be some experts in the world, but there are few. I think there are people who have a lot of good experiences and know a lot of things, but I mean, I would never consider myself an expert after 26 years. I would still say I've got a lot to learn. Interestingly, I read a book a while ago. It was written by a Canadian astronaut. I forget his name. I think it was Chris Hadfield, and he was talking about his 20 or 30 year career in NASA. And he was saying that, he always considered himself lucky to be there and very average at his job. But he realized upon reflection after he had retired that you don't put an average person in charge of the space station. And he commanded that twice. You don't put an average person in charge of a shuttle. And they did that. And so he had to actually start coming to terms with he wasn't actually average through his career. He was better than average. And he started to unpack this. And there's one chapter, there's one page in his book that really spoke volumes to me. And I think we've got a lot to learn in ParaMed from this too, where he said in every crew, he realized that there were minus ones, zeros, and plus ones. And he always considered himself an average astronaut as a zero. But again, you don't put a zero in charge of a shuttle. And so he had to accept that through his 30-year career, he was actually a plus one. But what he realized is that everyone that he thought was a plus one considered themselves a zero, himself included. And everyone who considered themselves a plus one was actually a minus one on that team. They just had no idea. They were still there. And so by default, he realized there's only ever actually plus ones and minus ones because the people who consider themselves a zero are actually normally plus ones in that role. And I find that a really interesting analogy, because so many people that I've worked with who I would consider plus ones would always consider themselves to be quite average. They're quite humble. They have no problem reflecting on things or owning mistakes. And then there are those who are just gung ho. And see, the same applies to my soldier experience. The gung ho guys that just wanted to get in a gunfight and wanted to fight people, often they were actually minus ones.
It's an interesting space, Sonny. I really agree. I'd like to ask these two about this because their roles at the moment are as clinical leads, right? And that's an important distinction. They're not managers, they're leaders, all right, in
That's
the
a big
clinical
distinction. I
space.
like this.
Yeah, it's a massive distinction, right?
Words matter.
Words matter. Yes, Lou, we're on this. Yes. Megan or Nick or both of you, like, in terms of what is important for your role as clinical leads, what do you see when you're on scene? What is the thing that makes you more or less effective? What makes you a plus one, a zero, or a minus one on a scene when you're considering like your skill sets, your knowledge and things, what in contributing to the scene?
Can I say communication, or is that just
Nah.
too straight
Too
to it?
broad. You're going to have to elaborate on that. Words matter, all right?
I think what I find it's about how you then insert yourself and embed yourself into that team. There is absolutely zero point coming in gung ho trying to, push yourself to the front of that team. If everything's working really, really well, you're just going to derail the situation, add absolutely no value, and make things infinitely worse. But it's about taking that time to come in, kind of observe what's going on in that scene, orientate yourself to like who's who in the zoo, what's happening, what do they need, where can I add value, or where can I just be a good follower, and then deciding what you're going to do. That's probably my approach to coming
What
in.
about you, Megan? Yes.
A similar sort of thing. I remember when we went through our training for the clinical lead induction, and Andy very pointedly said, "What can you add? Like when you rock up to a scene, what can you add?" And I look at our role as being more about empowering clinicians to be the best that they can be. So, it's quite a privilege being able to come in as the, whether you're the third person or the fifth person or whatever it may be, because you get quite a lot more situational awareness about what's going on, and you pick up on just these tiny little things that you can then suggest as little areas that they might have missed or, not looked at, but without taking an actual physical leadership role. I don't think I've really explained that all that well, but to
No,
empower that
you have.
clinician to maintain that leadership there.
It's an empowerment. I love the
Can
word.
I?
It's an empowerment role. Yeah, for sure.
My final placement as a student and talking about like your role and empowering clinicians. We had a case, and so I was, I suppose, what you'd say, like running the job. And I had an OIC and an acting OIC come to the job. And they both looked at me and they're like, "Okay, Lou, what do you want to do?" And I kind of stood back and was like, oh, like I knew exactly what I wanted to do and I had a plan, but it was so nice because they weren't there from the start. They came back to provide us, they came to provide us assistance. And having them stand there and go, you know, what would you like us to do, was so empowering as a student. And bringing it back to how Sunny said, you know, we're treating them like students, but we should be empowering them to feel like they're going to be clinicians very soon. And it was such a wonderful experience for me. And I took that on board and I thought, that's the type of clinician that I want to be, not someone that overpowers everyone, but listens, is understanding, and is empathetic, and empowers people to make decisions, or at least talk about the decisions of what they want to do. Because we spoke about it and they're like, yep, well, how about this or that? And it was great. It was that collaboration and really good effective communication. So what you just described was sort of what I experienced when I was on placement, and it was so nice to yeah, have that memory.
Remember,
Yes.
people remember how you made them feel. And
Yeah.
that's a very important part of communication. And the thing is, Lou, even Megan, those both draw up and conjure up, from, mid-20-year-old Sonny, being at one of his first big cases, having backup arrive is a very daunting thing. I'm trying to get everything done that I think I need to do so I don't lose face and so they can actually have faith in me. And I had two very different experiences the same week where, one of the officers who backed me up just stood over me. Why are you doing that? Why haven't you done this? And just, I felt like a little fingernail being cut off a finger. And the same week, and even, more nervous and more concerned, I had to call back up for a second time. And this person who came literally came down, knelt next to me, and said, "Gee, you're doing well. What do you need?" And I still get goosebumps from this because that little bit of reassurance, "Sonny, you're doing well. What do you need?" just was so incredibly powerful for the right reasons. I could have hugged her. And I find it interesting because the first thing we teach paramedics to do is assess danger, and the next thing we teach them to do is reassure people. And somewhere along our clinical career, we forget about that reassurance when we're backing up a junior officer. For some reason, we have people who want to stand over and diminish and belittle and just make you feel small. But there is so much power in "you're doing well. What do you need?" It comes from a place of support, and then it comes from a place of curiosity because, regardless of how I answered that next question, "What do you need?" she is going to be able to direct me in a place of encouragement, "You're on the right track," or a place of support, "Yeah, what about this?" And because I feel now I'm being supported, as soon as I get that, "Well, what about this?" I'm like, "Yeah, man, let's do that. In fact, can you just take over for now because I'm flapping?" So it's two very different experiences, but it speaks volumes to what I think you both just said. But I think the reassurance in leadership has been lost somewhere along the way in some, not in all. There's some really, really good people out there. Otherwise, none of us would have experienced this. But I think we need to bring back the reassurance from the leaders that we're actually there to support the subordinates. I mean, whenever I've been in a position of leadership, let's even call it, Andy, I'm going to call it management. When I've been in a position of management, ooh, right? The job is actually
I'm
to
just not sure you
serve
should
the
be in charge
people below me.
of anything.
What's that?
I said, I'm just not sure you should have been in charge of anything, just quietly.
No,
But
I
anyway, we'll
haven't.
just, that's another conversation.
Says the constructive disruptor, Andrew Bell. But anyway, it's one of those things where management is not about sitting on a pedestal, and leadership is not about sitting on a pedestal. If anything, we should be reversing it. We should actually be sitting under the officers who we're responsible for and lifting them. Because my job as a manager was actually to make sure they're paid, make sure they're clothed, make sure they've got equipment, make sure they're safe. I'm actually their servant, and that is not accepted well in the managerial text.
No, I think in terms of the leadership space, and again, I said management and leadership are not the same thing. I see one as quantifiable management, like the things you just listed. You know, like do they have enough clothes and do they have enough food, and right, that's all quantifiable. Leadership's more qualitative. It's more about how someone feels, or how you make someone feel, or how they feel about working with you and the like. To me, The concept of clinical leadership is something that we need to really drill into, and it comes back to this concept of us developing and evolving as a profession as well. More so, clinical leaders need to be empowered to be able to be humble leaders. The most humble leaders will be the ones who are the most effective, because they are the ones that will give you that opportunity to, they'll sit down beside you and say, "Hey, what do you need?" Lou, the experience that you had, which was like that feeling of like, "Hey, I'm being empowered here to do what I'm doing." That all comes from a place of humble leadership. And that's, again, not particularly sexy, right? It's not on the big list of like autocratic, democratic, blah, 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 leadership, but humble leadership is something that will allow us to push things forward. The problem is that requires people to let go of their egos. It also requires people to have a very firm understanding of, hold on, here we are. The language that they're using, the way they communicate things, words matter. All right. So, in order to be an effective, humble leader, you need to be have the vernacular, you have to have the vocabulary to be able to provide the things that the people around you need, which is, again, has to be learnt. We don't all just innately have these things, and these are the things that we should be starting to build into our leadership development, into the courses for when people are coming up through. You know, there's tons of so-called leadership courses and management courses, but how many of them teach you to be a humble leader? And Lou, you used the word empathetic before, and my God, empathy in a leader? Oh my goodness, who would have thought? All right, but gee, they're often the most effective. And certainly the feedback that I get about our clinical lead group is that when they are on scene and they are showing empathy and they are collaborative and they are communicating effectively, the crews feel better and they perform better. And that leads to a better patient outcome. And isn't that the whole point of this whole thing? Is like us providing better service to our patients. So there's a lot there. Again, I think we're going to need another 7 episodes at this point, because we've crossed a bunch of boundaries. But to me, humble leadership is a real a way forward for us.
From a lot of these examples, and it's no fault of anyone's, because like you said, we've only been registered since 2018. I mean, when Andy, back in the day when you and I joined, there was only really one pathway to be a paramedic, and that was in ambulance services. Fast forward, a decade, and we literally have paramedics on film sets. We have paramedics in stunt teams. We have paramedics in schools. We have paramedics in shopping centers. We have paramedics at events. We have paramedics in mine sites. We have paramedics doing international retrievals. You literally cruise ships. You can take paramedicine into just about every industry. The problem is there's still a very inherent bias in the profession that a paramedic needs to be in an ambulance. And a lot of the discussions have revolved around that. And I expected it to as well, because, we're speaking to three leaders from an ambulance service. And I think this cross collaboration is also very important. Like we're bringing the institutional jurisdictional services into a conversation with private sector specialists, and I think we both got a lot to share and a lot to learn. The irony is there's a lot of crossover between those as well, but in the private sector space, quite often the paramedics are actually working as an independent SME. Now that should challenge us all, because we've already just said there's not that many subject matter experts. But when you take a non-clinical environment, use a film set, for example. There are a lot of creative experts there. There are camera experts. There are producers. There are directors. There is only often one clinically qualified person. And so everyone on that set will look to this person like they are a clinical god, because they are. There's no one else there that has anything above a first aid certificate. Most of their first aid certificates are expired. So the clinician on set would be the subject matter expert for anything health related. How does that person learn to lead with no backup? How does that person learn to communicate effectively without colleagues? Because so much of our own education is focused around ambulance. In fact, I mean, look, we did a LinkedIn survey on this. It was a lot of fun. How many academics in Australia are from a non-ambulance background? None. So the bias in our own paramedic education in Australia is through the roof at the moment. But Andy, you and I both worked at the same universities at the same time, where we are both emphasizing we need to get non-ambulance academics, and often we are laughed at because they're not real paramedics. I mean, that story, that bias is rife. If you go to the College of Paramedicine's website, every single picture on every single page is an ambulance paramedic. So the bias against the private sector, you have to acknowledge it, and it makes people very uncomfortable because bias is an element of unprofessionalism. So this makes our profession quite upset. What's easier than owning a gap in our, own knowledge or a gap in our evidence-based practice is actually to stifle it and hide it. So I really want to spotlight these conversations too for the private paramedics that are out there listening to us speak, because a lot of the context of what we've talked about is, with backup and from an ambulance and with clinical leads, but there's thousands of paramedics working out there at the moment completely independently. And I know you can correct me if I'm wrong, but St. John have a private sector arm. You must be the only JIS in Australia that actually has a private sector arm. How does that work with the private sector and the independent paramedics out there practicing?
They're a solo operator clinician in a high-risk environment. Like it's almost the pinnacle of paramedicine in some regards when you look at like the job set that they need to do. They're on their own. They've got no backup. They've got no other clinicians around, in that immediate vicinity to be able to have things like communicate about jobs, to debrief on jobs, to get second opinions. Like we know there's that whole element of telemedicine that can support it, but we know the reality of that, right? There's not always signal. There's not always the ability to make those calls. It is a high-risk environment. So the challenge we've got is then how do we support them and how do we deliver that communication? And then they've got that second challenge then of how do they share their knowledge and their experience with the people they're working with? They almost need to become like a bit of a translator to, if they're working on a film set, right? They need to be able to share that clinical knowledge with the film crew, but they also then need to try and understand what the film crew are saying, what their needs are, and how they can interact in that environment. So it's probably a more flexible role. You need to understand a lot more moving parts.
I think you just nailed it too. There's so much talk about autonomous practice in ambulance, and I giggle because there's so much support in ambulance. So I've worked in several. It's the paramedics who are out there working in the private sector. You said it's almost a pinnacle, and I agree. The people who are out there are actually the trailblazers, showing us a new way to practice and a new place to take paramedicine. Unfortunately, it's a lot less supported, but the augments like telemedicine and things will improve. But it is such a high-risk place. And there's an irony to that as well, Nick, in that it is also less accepted, which is why some of these paramedics. I remember talking to a new graduate 3 years ago. He worked in the mine sites for 18 months, and he was really disappointed because he hasn't got a real job yet. And it kind of hurt me because, you could see that he was hurting. But then he talked to me about this job that he did where he spent 8.5 hours underground performing a unconscious extrication of a patient who was GCS6 in an ammonia pocket 800 meters below the surface, and he did the whole thing under breathing apparatus. So he managed this patient for 8.5 hours, nearly a kilometer underground, under breathing apparatus, GCS, who cares? They're sick. And he's still not valuing the job he's doing as a real paramedic. And I'm like, how many ambulance paramedics would be able to do that, bro?
None. That almost needs to be like a culture shift as well, with that idea that you can only be deemed a, quote quote, real paramedic if, you've got experience working on the ambulance, or, it's quite sad, really. It's a bit
Like an
disheartening.
ambulance is just a vehicle. It doesn't change the sort of paramedic you are. It's just about how you get to the job. Like, chatting to a lot of HEMS clinicians, they talk about the helicopter as just their ambulance. Like that's just their mode of transport. Whether you're a paramedic in an ambulance, a car, a helicopter, if you ride a push bike or an e-scooter, probably don't use the e-scooter because they're pretty dangerous. But, however you get to the job is however you get to the job. Like,
Could you imagine a bunch of paramedics on e-scooters? Oh my God,
I'd love to see
sirens.
that.
Andy, you need Segways and e-scooters.
Segways would be worse.
Yeah.
How could you take someone seriously turning up on a Segway? Seriously.
True.
When I was in Austria, I saw this guy with like a in full red, looked like what our flight paramedics look like, on one of those little single wheel electric,
Like a uni wheel.
a uni wheel, and he was a
Sick.
paramedic going through
See,
Salzburg.
that's a skill.
So there you go.
I
It's
love
very
that.
cool. Yeah.
I started learning German and
I
I was
think.
like, maybe I could maybe, transfer over to Austria and be a little Segway paramedic over there.
I think talking about I think Megan, you maybe mentioned culture. or Nick, that I think a lot of it starts, and I'm going to bring it back here, in the university setting. So for me, we would run, and Nick and Sunny, sorry, Andy and Sunny, you would get this. We run simulations where it's like, okay, so you're a paramedic working for an ambulance service. You're the primary officer. You've got a secondary officer. This is your backup. Blah blah blah. And that's how they run the scenarios. Not once was there ever a scenario where it's Lou, you're in a mine site. You have an emergency service officer who can assist you, trained to the level of a first aid officer. You've been called to a mining accident, blah blah blah, and you know your backup is a Royal Flyer Doctor Service or something like that. I would love to see that in the university setting because I truly believe that that would help even shape the way that students see the profession. Because I've had many conversations with students where I go, you know, there's so much more than an ambulance service. There's so much more you can do, and they're like, well, no. It's not a real job if it's not an ambulance service. And I just get stonewalled every time I talk to them. And it's so disappointing that it's starting at that stage and it just continues on. So I think there's some improvement we could do there in the university space where we could even just change our simulations to reflect, you know, the private sector paramedics or the guy on the unicycle, you know, wouldn't that be cool?
It almost needs to be like its own unit kind of built into the curriculum
Yeah,
for all these different
absolutely.
areas.
It's
Yeah.
I really like that, Lou. I think that's a cool idea. I think it's a really cool
Yeah.
idea. Yeah.
The challenge that presents to that is again culture and acceptance. Like I said, we battled to get non-ambulance service academic staff, which is where that would start from. But they're not deemed to be real or have real experiences. And I mean, that's disappointing because, there's so much emphasis on our clinical skills. I've even had people laugh at some of the roles I've done. On Shark Week, are you carrying morphine? No, we can't. We're traveling internationally. Oh, how are you a paramedic without morphine? I didn't see that in the professional capabilities document, must have morphine. It doesn't say that. It literally says act professionally, perform clinical assessment. Those domains are there. So it comes back, right back, unfortunately, ooh, to ego. And I mean, this is interesting too, because why can you be a nurse across Australia as a nurse, but you can't be a paramedic across Australia? Each service is still run by each independent state. And what that actually creates, I mean, Matt Wilkinson-Stokes worked for months with a team of about 30 researchers on the Clinical Guideline Manifesto to try and shed some light on this and get some exposure to it. But with each ambulance service essentially managing its own scope of practice, we actually treat our own citizens vastly differently. If you look at the Clinical Guideline Manifesto, it's still up on the shift extension as an archive. It's from 2023. There were six different ways that we would actually decide if someone's dead or not as a paramedic in Australia. Now, that means that across Australia, there are universities teaching the same program, but teaching a different criteria for death. The Clinical Guideline Manifesto delved into about 30 different conditions that we respond to map across posters how differently each service approaches things. And it comes down to, if you use the Queensland New South Wales border here, C Street, if you're struck by a car on C Street, it depends on what side of the road you're landing on, will actually dictate what kind of pre-hospital trauma treatment you will get, which will actually dictate the potential survivability of that issue. That's madness. I remember crossing the border years ago to back up a New South Wales crew on a cardiac arrest. And when it didn't have a good outcome, our time of death was a different time of death to theirs. How do you document this? I remember picking up a mental health patient and putting them under a, what did you used to call it here, Andy? I forget. It's been so long now, an EOI or something, or an EEA or EEA. And he was from Tweed, so we took him across to the Tweed Hospital. And the first nurse to come to me said, "Is he coded?" I said, "What is coded?" She said, "You haven't put him under an EEA from Queensland, have you?" I said, "I did." She said, "Well, that has no legal bearing here. You've actually kidnapped this man." I rung the clinical lead for that. "Hey, man, I'm in New South Wales. I kidnapped someone. What do I do?" I'm pretty sure he hung up on me. Your problem. There is so much discrepancy between what the individual ambulances are doing That actually influences what the universities are teaching, because each university will teach what that state service is doing, because that's where the academics are drawn from. And so, where we're talking about the universities requiring a need to, bring in the profession, not just the ambulance side of it. I mean, I think as the profession grows, the ambulance side might only be about 25% of what paramedics can do. It's still going to be one of the largest employers, and we, like, I still love ambulance service. I work for half a dozen. But looking at what paramedics can do, there's a massive discrepancy between what's actually represented. But it also comes back to the state services and how they have so much influence over the academic sector, which is teaching the next generation.
I think you're right. Language, again, communication, all of the pieces that we've been talking about fit into this. And it's, we've focused probably quite a bit on interpersonal communication, but there's also systemic and organizational communication as well, which is where you've kind of gone now, Sunny, in terms of like, how should these different services be talking to each other? Are different services talking to each other? Are different aspects of paramedicine, i.e., industrial health, event health, jurisdictional and the like, talking to each other? We're probably a little way off it yet, if we're completely honest, in terms of finding our way to that. But at least there's some conversation being had in that space, because there never used to be. There was no conversation at all. But organizational language is a whole nother beast to manage. Organization, collaboration, interoperability. There was a recent coronial inquiry came through off the back of the Bondi stabbings. It's public knowledge. This is not a hidden document. Anyone can access it. And there are, I couldn't tell you how many. I'm going to say dozens, just as an easy number, of comments made regarding interoperability. And this is not to point a finger at any single one service or any one state or anything else, but rather just that we still don't work well in the same, we don't all play in the same sandpit particularly well. And a huge part of that is the language. You'll have three different services. You'll have a fire service, a police service, and an ambulance service, or whatever you want to call it, all attending something, let's call it like an MVA, right? Like a motor vehicle accident type thing. And they're all operating from their own SOPs, their own standard operating procedures, and they all have their own language around that SOP. So you're all doing the same thing at the same job, but you're all doing it using different language. So of course there's going to be a breakdown in the communication. Of course there's going to be a breakdown in an understanding of what each other does. And that leads to a detrimental impact on the way that we provide our service. So if we can start to improve the comms, the collaboration, and therefore the interoperability between services, we will start to see an improvement across things. And likewise, Sunny, to your piece around things like industrial health, I did spend, I've had it, I've dabbled in that space myself. I've worked for the Royal Flying Doctor Service over here in WA. I've worked on mine sites here and offshore and the like.
I saw a photo of you dangerously close to the edge of an oil platform. You were past the sign that said, "Do not go past."
I'm not a good reader. Lou mentioned it earlier that I'm just not very good at much, to be fair. So, in a space like that, you're talking about a patient being handed from a paramedic that's working on an industrial site, maybe for an industrial partner, like a big resource company or something like that, being passed to another industry partner, someone like the Royal Flying Doctor Service, who are then providing an aeromedical component to the travel, and then being passed probably to an ambulance service because that patient still needs to get to a hospital, and then they're being passed to a hospital. So somewhere along that patient's journey, they've been through three, four, five, six different medical providers, five, six different handovers and the like. If we don't get better at a shared language, then that's where we start to see a breakdown in things like we see that effect of that Chinese whispers in our handovers. Important things are missed. Oh, the piece of why that person got injured or how they got injured at point of contact is lost, because by the time they get through five sets of hand and they arrive on the surgeon's table in a hospital somewhere, it's been completely lost because the communication wasn't effective. So to me, we've talked about interprofessional communication, collaboration, but another layer, a huge another level, is operational and organized organizational interoperability, collaboration, and communication. So there's another piece as well. We should have that one solved by lunchtime, I reckon.
It's been an interesting conversation. There's so much that we could have unpacked, but limited time, and there's so many interesting ideas and areas that we can explore to improve things. But I mean, one of the things that I come back to is the whole purpose of this was to collaborate. It was literally, I mean, Lou, we talked. I don't think we found another jurisdictional ambulance with its own podcast, did we?
No.
No. So, I mean, that in by definition means that this is actually quite progressive in the way that we are communicating in paramedicine. It's also, and look, Andy, this isn't supposed to stroke your ego, so I'll let Megan slap you later. But it's also been historically difficult for us to get anyone from assistant commissioner and above to come on the podcast through fear of saying something that might impact their role. And I find that interesting that the leaders are fearful of actually speaking publicly about things. And so we're both, Lou and I, are really grateful, one, that we had a jurisdictional ambulance prepared to talk to us, because we've been accused of being anti-ambulance in the past. And I'm like, we're not anti-ambulance, we're just pro-private service. I mean, can't we be both? I've worked for six ambulance services, for goodness sake. But, kudos to all three of you. One, for setting up the podcast and putting yourselves out there, because one of the things that Lou and I have learned is that when you put yourself out there publicly, people are going to love it and people are going to hate it. So the criticism does fly. And I mean, we were speaking about serotonin syndrome last year, and I had someone, a colleague, ring me up and make fun of me. You didn't even know what you're talking about. And my point was, I know. That's why we had that guest on, so I could learn. I haven't been on serotonin syndrome in 6 years. Kudos to you guys, one, for raising the podcast and having these open chats. But also, I really think that we need to acknowledge that all three of you coming on the podcast with us is a huge risk. And it's really humbling to know that there are clinical leaders in the profession who are prepared to have really difficult conversations and awkward moments, and listen to things that can challenge us too, because I find whenever I've been challenged, it sucks. But when you reflect on it, there's so much I could have learned in that moment that often I'm picking up the phone again saying, "Hey man, can we chat?" Yeah, hey Nick, what's something you could have known as a junior paramedic?
I think if when I was coming up as a student, all I needed was someone to sit me down and just say, all at the end of the day you need to remember is just be a good person and let that guide every decision. And it's pretty simple.
Well, I like that. That is fair. Andy, I mean, I don't know if you can remember being young.
Wow,
So rude.
I know, right? It's lucky I like him, isn't it?
Yeah,
All right.
I know.
Well, I'll have words,
Sorry
don't
about
worry.
him. That's
That's okay.
good.
I took my kids to Easter service over Easter, right? And the congregation was chock-a-block full because of knobheads like me that take the kids there once a year. So there was nowhere to sit. And I'm ex-army, like, who cares? There's carpet, that looks comfy. So I just went and plonked myself on the floor in the aisle with my kids. And this young girl sitting nearby looked horrified. And my first instinct was, oh, I've offended this knobhead, right? But she jumped up from her seat, and quick as day, she's like, "Oh my God, sir, would you like my seat?" And I'm like, "What the hell? No, that's what I do as a young man. I offer you my, oh, you bitch, you've seen an old man's tattoo." And that same week, I went to get a haircut. And the barber says, "Do you want me to trim your eyebrows?"
Oh no. Oh
Oh no.
no. Better than offering to
It's
trim your nose
begun.
hair.
That's true.
That's coming.
Oh no. That is
So,
true.
Andy, I'm in the same boat.
Yeah, I know you are, mate. That's right. Because the beauty of this is you will have forgotten this conversation in 5 minutes. So that's
Don't worry,
fine.
I'll remind him.
Look, if there was one thing that I'd been taught, it was to be kind to yourself. This job is hard, whether or not, regardless of where you do it, whether or not it's in a jurisdictional ambulance service or an industrial mine site or on a film set or anywhere else, there are incredible things about this job. You get to do things that other people don't get to do. You get to see things that other people don't get to see. You get to be a part of the world. But it can also grind you down, you know, and cumulatively, this job can be very difficult. Hours can be difficult. Shift work can be difficult. Long days on TV sets and the like can be very difficult. It can be difficult for friends and family because you're away often. And you know, if you're doing expedition medicine, for example, you can be gone for weeks or months on at a time. So there are things about this job that can be really hard. There are also things, and you know, that age-old question of what's the worst thing that you've ever seen. I hate that. I'm never going to answer it. But the answer is that sometimes things aren't pleasant. Sometimes you do see things that people that aren't easy to process, and so it's okay sometimes to just not be okay. It's okay to have a few downtimes, but it's also really important to recognize that you need to look after yourself first because you can't be good at treating other people and managing other people and helping other people if you can't help yourself. So eat well, sleep well, don't do things too silly. Make sure you get out, enjoy the fresh air, enjoy time with your kids and the like, because those are the things that will get you through the rest of the job. Be
So true.
kind.
So true. Megan, you've had time now.
I'm very grateful that I was left to last because I had time to think. I think my advice would just be to stay curious. So you can, I think paramedicine is such a wonderful field in the sense that you will never learn everything. You can never know everything that there is to know, and things are constantly changing and it's very dynamic. So I think just maintaining that level of curiosity and constantly asking questions and seeking feedback and improving yourself and learning and changing is a good thing throughout your whole career.
Lou, what a wild chat this has been.
It's been great. What a privilege.
That's been fun.
Well,
Thanks for having us.
to have all three. Yeah, no, thank you. Yeah, I think what a great topic to talk about, but I just think we could talk for hours on this particular topic. It's so relevant, clearly, to our profession and how we operate and work. So thank you guys. And thank you also for listening to me talk. You know, I feel like I have a lot of experiences as a student, and sometimes it's nice to be able to share that with people who have been in that role for a lot longer, and who are at a senior position, and for you to actually listen and hear what I have to say. Because my experience is, you know, I sort of sometimes feel like I speak on behalf of so many other students that have gone through the degree. So I feel like I'm a bit of a voice for them as well. So yeah, thank you guys. Great chat. We should do it again.
Thank you, guys.
Folks, that's Shift Extension Podcast with the CPR Podcast. If you like you heard, jump on the website shiftextension.org. If you want to hear this in person, we've got Andy coming all the way across the country with a bunch of other speakers. The Respond Conference, respondconference.com.au. It is where we're really unpacking creative careers and new ideas. We deliver it differently. There are no PowerPoints. It is just real speakers with real experiences, and it is entertainment through education. Folks, thank you.